Trevor is an old friend. He has spoken at a number of events with Paul and myself. We love him. I know you do too. That's why we have a great crowd here tonight. You know that he loves America. And he doesn't just love America because it's America. We're no better than any other people, but we are an exception. And it's not that we're exceptional people. We're the exception to the rule. Because we have experienced what very few people have ever experienced in history. And that's why we talk about American exceptionalism. We're no better, maybe not even as good as other people groups around the world because of the way we've squandered God's blessings. But we are the exception, but we are quickly becoming the rule because we have forgotten who we are. And one of his passions is to remind us who we are. And so he's doing all that he can do to expose the radical left and its covert influence on mainstream politics. So why don't we put our hands together and give another very warm welcome to Mr. Trevor Loudon. It's good to have you, brother. Thank you for coming, man. We're glad you're here.
Thanks, Dan.
God bless you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks so much, Dan. And I'm sorry Paul isn't here tonight. But can everybody hear me down the back okay? Can you understand the southern accent all right? I worry about that. Okay. I want to say a couple of things before I start really. But I'm going to do a little bit of a hybrid tonight. I'll talk about the situation in America, but also a little bit about the churches and the problems in the church. But, first thing I'll say is, you know, I come from New Zealand and you know, I was just back in New Zealand a while ago, and my 90-year-old dad, you know, was telling me about how terrified they were during World War II of an invasion by the Japanese. And it brought home to me, if it hadn't been for the sacrifice of your fathers and grandfathers and uncles who stopped the Japanese at Guadalcanal and Coral Sea and Midway, I might not be here, folks. It's very personal. I'd like to say thank you to your family's sacrifice for saving my family during the war. Now, I've got a couple of things relevant to Oklahoma. The first time I ever came to Oklahoma, which I love coming here, by the way, and a big shout out to Charlie Meadows down the back there. He's a great host. He's a great man. And congratulations on your victory, Charlie. Okay. But the first time I ever came here, I came from New Zealand at 45 degrees to Oklahoma at 113 degrees. Well, this time I come and it's only 107 degrees. So Paul and Dan eating all those tofu burgers and driving Priuses has made a big difference. Okay, so congratulations, guys. Thanks for that. Now, here's my other Oklahoma story. I used to have it when I first started, and I've got a website called KeyWiki. And when I was starting it, I had a young man called Andy Moore helping me, assisting me, and working for several. And he was a big guy in the pro-life movement. He was probably the top activist in New Zealand for pro-life. And he brought a woman, an American woman out called Jill Stanek. And he toured her around the country, visiting all the pro-life groups all around the country. And Jill liked Andy, so she said, "Look, Andy, I got a daughter called Dana. I think you'd get on really, really well with her. She lives in Texas, but you know, maybe you could try Skyping her sometime." So I noticed that Andy was coming into work dog tired every morning. Because apparently he'd been Skyping with Dana till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, you see. And after a while, this was clearly developing. So he said, "Look, Trevor, I want to go to America for 3 months to really get to know Dana. I can get a 90-day visa to go to America. Can I have 3 months off work? I promise I'll be back." And I said, "Yeah, okay, Andy, you know, not, don't want to stand in the way of something like that." So he goes there, and on day 89... he phones me up and says, "Oh, Trevor, Dana and I are getting married. I won't be coming back." So I said, okay, well, that's cool, Alan. I'm very happy for you. And then I get a call 2 days later. He said, well, we're in Texas and my visa was running out the next day and we wanted to get married, but in Texas it takes 2 days. And I was going to go over my visa. I said, what did you do? Well, we said we drove up to Oklahoma because in Oklahoma it's only 1 day. And they got married. So that's how Oklahoma became known as the Sooner State. Okay? That's true. Okay? But that's true, except for the last bit. That was all true. So I want to talk a little bit about church and a couple of things. Then I want to talk about the situation in America and what we need to do. Now, I want to start with a story. It's a bit of a love story, but not a conventional story. Now, I got a friend who was a former special forces leader. He had led men into combat. He's got bullet wounds to prove it. A very, very brave, patriotic soldier at a very high level. But a few years ago, he had the biggest challenge of his life that took the most courage, and it was right in his own home. So he had a 16-year-old son who was smoking marijuana every single day. And this is a very Christian household, a very good household. And this was driving the family crazy. You know, no matter what they'd say to the son, he just wouldn't listen. He'd go up in his room and just smoke all day. Wouldn't go out to work, wouldn't do anything, just smoking, smoking, smoking. And the dad said, look, son, we're going to get tough on you. We'll kick you out of home if you don't stop this. And mum would say, no, we can't do that. We can't cast him out. We have to nurture him through this. We have to get him through this. We have to be, you know, just hang with him. And eventually dad made a decision. And he got his son, 16 years old, put him in the back of his car, took him down to the local shopping mall and said, son, this is your home until you learn to love your family more than you love marijuana. Bye. He put him out on the pavement and he drove home praying and choking back tears all the way home. 5 days they heard nothing, not a peep. Five horrible, horrible days. Then on the fifth day, they get a knock on the door and here's the young boy. He says, Dad, I'm so sorry. I'm never going to smoke that junk again. Can I please come home? And he turned out good. He's married in the church, active, got a business. It all turned out well. But the point here is this. Every family knows there are two kinds of love. Because Christianity today is all about love. It's a favorite word, right? Every family knows there's two kinds of love. There's the love of the mother who will pick you up when you fall over. She'll bandage your knee. She'll bake cookies with you. She'll tell you nursery rhymes. She'll just love you unconditionally. But then there's the love of the father who will boot your little backside if you disrespect your mother, who will take his son to the ball game and fishing and hunting and to the woodshed when necessary, who will teach his son to be a man and his daughter to be a lady. Is any family better with both kinds of love? You gotta have the mother, you gotta have the father, right? How many young men are rotting in jail today because they never had a dad? You know, to take them to the game, to look after them, to mentor them. And how many young women are drifting from relationship to relationship, wasting their time because they wouldn't know a good man if they fell over one, because they never saw one. So the point I'm getting at here is, when the churches talk about love, what kind of love are they mainly emphasizing these days? It's more the feminine type, isn't it? We will accept you. It's okay. You know, we'll look after you. We'll welcome you. There's very little of the masculine love. And I'm not talking about this church because I know what Paul's like. But most churches, there's very little of the calling to account. There's very little of the tough kind of love that you really, really need to shape families and shape people. Am I wrong in this, folks? And we're seeing in our society, young men grow up, they have female teachers, they don't have a dad, They go to church and they have a really, you know, pansy pastor. And, you know, it's just, it's not, and you wonder why young men spend all their lives in basements playing computer games or smoking dope all day or working in dead-end jobs with no real ambition. It's not hard to figure out, is it? Now, I want to go back and say, explain a little bit of how we got to this. And one thing, who's ever heard the phrase situation ethics? Okay, if you haven't heard of it, you're probably living by it to some degree or another, because it's a very bad thing. But we're all living by it. Situation ethics is the concept that there is no fixed morality. There's no biblical morality. There's no Ten Commandments. They're all invalid. They're all old-fashioned. We should make our moral decisions based on love, based on the best outcome. You know, you think of a young woman. She's in a PhD program at a very expensive university. She's invested $200,000 in her education. She's going to be a great public servant one day when she finishes her degree. But she falls pregnant. And dad and the boyfriend's not a suitable father. She doesn't want to marry him. And she's faced with the decision. If I have this child, that's going to screw up my school. It's going to really, really damage my career. I'll probably be poor for a long time. And I won't be able to give the child the kind of family that I want to give it. Maybe the most loving thing to do is to have an abortion. This is the kind of logic, is situation ethics. The pastor who says, well, I love my people, I love my church, but I notice when I talk about the tough stuff, when I talk about hell or sin or repentance or holding people to account, or I get a little bit hard on people sometimes, I notice some people get very uncomfortable. And some of them don't come back. Maybe in the loving spirit I should soften the message down a little bit. Maybe I should de-emphasize the tough parts of the Bible and maybe talk about the gentler, kinder parts. Do you ever see this logic in operation, folks? This is how most people make most decisions. Really, in America today. And this philosophy came from a man called Joseph Fletcher. He was one of the leading Protestant theologians in America in the 50s and 60s. He lectured all over the world, wrote multiple books, and he was the man who gave us situation ethics. He is the father of this philosophy. Well, and it came right at the perfect time because it was in the 60s. And this was, you know, when Marcuse and that had been telling everybody, you know, make love, not war, drop out, the hippie thing was coming along. You know, it was the 60s generation was spoiled rotten by their parents who had been through the Depression and World War II, and they wanted their kids to have an easier life than they did. It all came together. People wanted a new guiding philosophy, and it took the country and the church by storm. Well, Joseph Fletcher was not your ordinary churchman, because when he'd written his book and done his damage, he renounced the church, declared himself an atheist, and helped to set up an organization which advocated for euthanasia to handicapped children for up to 10 years of age. You also understand that he helped Margaret Sanger set up Planned Parenthood. He was also, for many years, active in Communist Party fronts in Alabama and Ohio. Then he went to Massachusetts, where he worked his way up through the local seminary there, the theological college, while still attending Communist Party meetings on a regular basis. He was the leader of the World Peace Council, which was set up by Stalin to disarm America. He was a member of the U.S.-Russia Friendship Society, a communist front. This man was an atheistic communist, but he changed the morality of a nation. He basically abolished the Ten Commandments for millions of Americans and replaced it with this airy-fairy system of morality based on feminine love, that has changed the entire culture. One bad guy changed the culture of America, and we're still suffering from it today. All around us, we're suffering from this. But this is what they do. The enemies of America decided a long time ago they could never take down America from the outside. It would have to be from the inside. And what is the heart of America? It is the church. And the church has money. And the church has influence. And the church has respectability. All things that revolutionaries crave. That is why we did our movie, Enemies Within the Church, folks. It traces a whole history of the communist infiltration of churches, right back from Joseph Fletcher through the left-wing evangelicals of the 70s, the Ron Siders, etc., to the takeover of the Bible colleges, Campus Crusade for Christ, World Vision, the Southern Baptists that are ongoing right now. These are all under Marxist infiltration right now. And if we lose those institutions, folks, we lose America. Just from the voting alone, we'll lose America, let alone the spiritual degradation that goes with it. You know, when the church is sound and leading the community, the families tend to be in good repair. The families tend to be solid. And the civil government stays within its boundaries. When the church abandons its leadership or perverts its role, the families fall into chaos and the civil government gets out of control. Is that where we are now, folks? You think the churches are leading the communities like they should be around America? There are exceptions, but that's the thing, they are exceptions. And you are very, very wise to choose a church like this. So, and I'll go back to courage, and I'll come back to courage a little bit later. How do you tell if you have a faithful pastor? Because he will be a courageous pastor. Because courage is proof of faith. If you, in the book of Revelations, there's a list of people who are cast into the pit of hell. And there's idolaters, there's murderers, there's whatever. Do you know who the very first people on the list are? The cowards. Cowardice is not a moral failing. Cowardice is a sin. Cowardice is sinful because cowardice means you have no faith. You don't believe in anything. If you believe in God and you believe in eternity, really, what do you fear on earth? Are you scared of the county commission? Are you scared of the IRS? Are you scared of Facebook? What are you scared of if you have faith in eternity, people? Exactly. So this is why cowardice is a sin. Because it means I have no faith in God. I have no faith in anything beyond myself. All I have is my sorry little life, and I'll make any compromise and tell any lie to preserve what little I have, because I believe in nothing beyond this little life. You imagine if every politician in this country made their decisions based on eternity rather than the next 2 years, do you think we'd have a different country? That is the consequence. The consequences we are suffering in our families, our civil government, are the result of a failure, a failure of true faith, which leads to true courage. We are only going to get out of the mess we are if people boldly proclaim the truth whenever they can. But that's challenging, that's hard, there's consequences for that. So to have that, you've got it, to do that, you've got to have a lot of courage. But where does your courage come from, people? Comes from your faith, your belief, doesn't it? You don't have that faith, you don't have that courage. If your pastor's not a courageous man, you ask why. Because the role of a pastor, he carries a crook. You know, a shepherd. And the crook is supposed to discipline the flock quite harshly at times And it's also supposed to beat the wolves away. Are there any wolves coming after your kids right now? Are there any wolves in your schools? Are there any wolves in your government? So why is your pastor not leading you to fight those wolves away? Is that the role of any decent pastor? To be a courageous, bold man? And if they're not, you got to ask why. And if you're in a church like that, why are you following a man who has no faith in what he professes to believe? Am I being a little harsh here, people? The country defends it, everything depends on this, people. So I want to talk a little bit about the country, then I want to bring it back to our role. Now, has anybody in this room ever had to undergo a background check or get a security clearance for any government or military position? Okay. Well, is it true those background checks are extremely rigorous? They'll go through your family background, they'll look for criminal convictions, bounce checks, they'll check out your family, they might go and interview your youth pastor or your high school teacher. They want to know if there's anything suspicious in your background, because you're protecting the Constitution here, folks. And this country has enemies who want to bring down that Constitution, and they don't want you being part of the problem. But what if you're a young Marxist radical who hangs around with the local Communist Party and the local unions, and they get you elected to the US Congress or the US Senate, where you may serve on the Homeland Security Committee or the Armed Services Committee or the Intelligence Committee? How much of a background check do those people undergo, people? Zero. There are no background checks in Congress or the Senate at all. You need a background check to hold a role, an officer's role in the military. But you don't to be chairman of the Armed Services Committee. You need a background check to be in the FBI or the CIA, but you need nothing to be chairman of the Intelligence Committee or the Homeland Security Committee. You think maybe China knows about this, or Iran, or North Korea, but they wouldn't use that against us, would they? Surely not. But don't panic, don't worry. There's no way that traitors or spies or communists could ever get into the US government, because we have an institution specifically designed to stop that happening, and that's the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You feel better now. You feel relieved. You know, once the FBI was an extremely professional and extremely patriotic organization, now it is working for the other side, unfortunately, at the leadership level. But even if the FBI was still run by patriots as it was, they have a very big problem, and it's led us to where we are. Now, the FBI is overseen by the most powerful committee in the Congress, that is the Judiciary Committee. Now, that oversees the FBI and the Justice Department, and how it's meant to work is the FBI catches the bad guys and the Justice Department prosecutes the bad guys. How's that been going recent times? Not so great. Now, does anybody remember, some of you older people here may remember, a congressman from Michigan, a man called John Conyers. Okay? He was in Congress from 1965 to 2017. And for over 40 years, he was either the chairman of the Judiciary Committee or the ranking Democrat. He was the man who abolished your House Un-American Activities Committee, right? One of your last lines of defense against internal subversion. That was in 1975. And his big enemy in the Congress was Larry McDonald of the John Birch Society. And I'm sure a few people here know the name Larry McDonald, a great American patriot, killed when the Soviets shot down a jetliner over South Korea in 2003, was it? Very suspicious, that was. But anyway, Conyers abolished that. Conyers had a 50-year history with the Communist Party USA. He was a card-carrying member of Democratic Socialists of America, a Marxist organization, and he was also a big-time supporter of several Muslim Brotherhood front groups. And if you're not sure who the Muslim Brotherhood are, they were a semi-secret society that started out in Egypt about 1929, and their goal was worldwide Islam. During World War II, they worked with the Nazis. After World War II, they worked with the Soviet KGB. They set up the Palestine Liberation Organization, Hamas, and several other terrorist organizations. They are the father of modern terrorism in the world. Yet in America, they work legally in this state through the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Muslim Student Associations, which has chapters in virtually every campus in Oklahoma, I believe. So when some of your Republican congressmen tried to get the Muslim Brotherhood designated as a terrorist organization a few years ago, John Conyers, he's on tape in my movie Enemies Within, says, no, no, we can't go after the Muslim Brotherhood. They're a peaceful social service agency now. We should work with them, not against them. John Conyers was a hardcore anti-American Marxist-Leninist. As hardcore as you can get, folks, working for the Soviet Union most of his career, selling America out. Yet he oversaw the Justice Department and the FBI. Now, in recent times, before the Republicans took over, and Jim Jordan's now running the committee, do you know who the last Democrat chairman of the House Judiciary Committee was? You've seen him on TV. He takes up the whole screen. Nadler, you getting it? Jerry Nadler, right? The man who tried to impeach President Trump twice. Jerry Nadler is also a long-time card-carrying member of Democratic Socialists of America. The man is a Marxist. Yet he oversees the Justice Department and the FBI. See, this is what they do. They got Conyers into that position. He had to go. So they replaced him with another Marxist from exactly the same little Marxist organization. And he went after the president, tried to impeach him twice. Just by the way, the head of the Homeland Security Committee in the last Congress, the man, Benny Thompson from Mississippi, the man who runs who's running the January the 6th witch hunts, you know, catching people who took selfies on Capitol Hill with FBI help. Well, that man used to be involved with a supporter of the Republic of New Africa. That was a Black Panther group in the 70s that was known to have killed at least six policemen. He was involved with the Communist Party USA, Democratic Socialists of America, and the Communist Workers Party. But he also went to Cuba in 2000 and did a deal with Fidel Castro to give medical scholarships, seven-year medical scholarships, to 140 young Americans, mainly the sons and daughters of Communist Party members, to train in Cuba to basically become Cuban agents. And this is the head of the Homeland Security Committee, a man who should be being investigated by the Homeland Security Committee, not heading it. As I say in my literature, we got 100 members of the House and 40 members of the US Senate who are so involved with China, the communists, the globalists, the Islamists, or the local communists, they couldn't pass a background check to drive a school bus in any county in Oklahoma. But they were running every committee in Congress, and they're still running every committee in the US Senate. But at least we have a moderate Democrat in the White House. Well, that's what the New York Times told us, right? And the Washington Post. He's going to bring the country together. He's an old-fashioned moderate Democrat. He's practically Harry Truman come back, you know? Well, how's that worked out? But I'm not going to talk about his communist background so much, but it's very deep. It's in my book, White House Reds. He's been working for the communists since 1972, which is why he's gutting your military. He's leaving your borders wide open. You're no longer energy independent. Oh, look, I'll go back a little bit before this. So here's an imaginary scenario. Don't get excited. This is just imaginary. Imagine one day the FBI wakes up and they think, we're losing our country. We haven't been doing our job. We've got 100 members of the House and 40 members of the Senate working against the country. They are the reason the borders are wide open. They are the reason Iran's about to get the nuclear bomb. They are the reason we're no longer energy independent. They are the reason the transgenders are running through our schools and the standards are going out the down the toilet. They are the reason Hollywood is totally woke. Sport is totally woke. Churches are going the same way. They are wrecking the country. We better darn well do something. Let's go to our bosses on the Judiciary Committee. Let's go and see Mr. Nadler. Let's go and see Mrs. Chu from California, who used to be supporting the Communist Workers' Party, the Chinese Communists. Let's go and see them. Mrs. Chu, Mr. Nadler, we need to investigate at least 100 of your Democratic colleagues in the House for working against the country. Do you mind? And by the way, Mrs. Chu, by the way, Mr. Nadler, you're both on the list. Is that all right? You think the FBI is stupid enough to bite the hand that feeds them? You think they're going to risk their careers and their pensions to call out their own bosses? Why didn't they go after Hillary Clinton for her service? She left secure information on open servers, which we know were hacked by both Russia and China. And she got nothing. If any of you guys with security clearances had done that, you'd still be in Leavenworth at the turn of the next millennium. You'd never get out, would you? But she got off because she could be the president and she could destroy the FBI. Or even worse. So this is the problem. There are no background checks in Congress. If you're on the left, the media will protect you. And the FBI doesn't dare to go after you. That is why we have 40% of the Congress and 40% of the US Senate basically working consciously against this country for money or ideology. How can any country survive that, folks? Does that make you understand why the borders are wide open? Does that make you understand why Biden wants to resurrect the nuclear deal with Iran to give them nuclear weapons? Does that make you understand why your kids are all getting indoctrinated in schools? Why your military is being destroyed before your very eyes? Why Biden gave Afghanistan to China? People, if President Biden was there to destroy the US economy, destroy the US military, destroy US borders, destroy your national integrity and your take away your freedom, what would he be doing differently than he is today? Nothing. It's not stupidity, people. I'm sick of people who say the stupidity of the Biden administration. This is conscious evil. That is what it is, and we do ourselves a major disservice when we say it's just stupidity. We are being stupid if we think this is just stupidity. If it was just stupidity, wouldn't they make a mistake in our favor once in a while? So I'll get back to Biden. I'm not going to talk about Biden, but I want to talk about one of his cabinet secretaries because there's an Oklahoma connection here. Does anybody know who the current Secretary of the Interior of the United States is? So you don't know because she's such a total non-entity. She was a second-term congresswoman from New Mexico called Deb Haaland. Okay? Nobody ever heard of her. Well, what was the very first thing that Joe Biden did when he came to office? First thing. The pipeline, remember? Shut down the Keystone Pipeline. 11,000 American workers just out of a job straight off like that because Native Americans had been protesting in the Dakotas, right? And they've been protesting for some time. There was some sabotage going on. There was a bit of violence, but constant protest because it was going through their tribal lands. This was the reason given. So Biden wanted to respect the Native Americans and closed it down. Well, the woman who organized those protests was a Caddo Indian from Oklahoma, a woman called Judith LeBlanc. Judith LeBlanc is also on the Central Committee of the Communist Party USA, which supports both Xi's China and Putin's Russia today, right now. She organized all those protests. Then she went out and did major voter registration drives amongst the Native American reservations in Montana, Nevada, Arizona, Minnesota, and New Mexico, all for Biden-Harris, to get the vote out for Biden-Harris, because they knew the Native Americans leaned heavily Democrat, but they didn't normally vote in big numbers. So she went out, she held a presidential forum in Sioux City, Iowa, got a whole lot of the presidential candidates there, and she got out the vote. Made a difference, I believe, in Montana, probably Arizona, probably Nevada as well. So, and as a reward for this, she was allowed to nominate her very, very good friend, Deb Haaland, as U.S. Secretary of the Interior. Now, Deb Haaland is a Marxist. I've got pictures of her holding up signs for the Party of Socialism and Liberation, a pro-North Korean, pro-Iran, pro-Cuba organization. And she's waving their banners like, no worries. Well, nobody knew who she was. Secretary of the Interior is a very important position. So there had to be a campaign mounted to make her known. So Judith LeBlanc mounted a campaign, a big public campaign called Deb for Interior. And they had buses. It was like a political campaign. They had buses and radio ads and Facebook and Twitter storms. And they had a whole bunch of celebrity endorsements. They got Mark Ruffalo and Alyssa Milano and Cher and Hanoi Jane Fonda and Sarah Silverman and Gloria Steinem all together. Deb for Interior, Deb for Interior. Big campaign. And Biden nominated her. And she went before the U.S. Senate, and she was confirmed with four Republican senators voting for her. When I say Republican, I mean Rhino. I'm talking Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, the Democrats in Republican clothing, right? You know them all. And they vote, she's confirmed. So now she oversees 20% of North America, most of Alaska, the border areas, all the Native American reservations, all of the energy extraction on public lands, all of the uranium mining on Native American lands, it's under her control. And she is shutting down every single energy lease she possibly can. Do you think that might please Xi Jinping? Do you think Vladimir Putin might be happy that that's keeping the price of oil high? When Biden has cut our strategic petroleum reserve that we need in time of war in half, including selling a whole chunk of it to China, she is closing down any opportunity to drill more oil and pump more gas on public land. 20% of America. And Biden's out there begging Venezuela and Iran to sell us gas. Enemies of this country, both of them. That is what treason does to a country, folks. We could be in a war with China in a week. And because of Biden and Haaland, we'll be running out of gas very, very quickly. But don't worry, Jennifer Granholm, the Secretary of Energy, another Marxist, is going to convert all our military vehicles to electric by 2030. So we'll be good. So when we get into a battle with China, we're going to have timeouts. You know, this is a great, we're getting in a battle and we're running out of, the battery's running down. The Chinese are going to give us a timeout so we can charge the battery up before we start fighting again. This is not stupidity, people. This is what they call sabotage. It's exactly what it is. So I want to talk a little bit about China. Now, okay, May 2019, President Trump put tariffs on Chinese goods. Great, good move. First thing the Chinese Xinhua news agency says is, in response to America's aggression, we declare people's war on the United States. And what does people's war mean? You know, people say, oh, what are they going to put tariffs on American goods? People's war is a term from Mao Zedong. It means to destroy your enemy through unconventional methods before your soldiers even put their boots on. So they're marching into a conquered country. People's war is 80,000 young American kids dying of fentanyl every year. That's deliberate people's war. That's 80,000 of your young kids who will never serve in the US military. People's war is buying your farmland, stealing your technology, buying your congressman. Trump's intelligence advisor Ratcliffe said, 3 years ago the Chinese already owned enough US congressmen that they can determine which legislation passes your Congress and which doesn't. It is corrupting your kids through Hollywood and TikTok. It's big tech canceling you. It is Wall Street selling your country out. Trump had to stop big Wall Street investment banks taking your military pension funds and investing them in China so they could build more bombs to kill the people who paid for them. Trump had to stop that. That's all people's war. All of it. And it is also biological warfare. Now, I cannot prove that the COVID came out exactly when it did to hurt President Trump the maximum and wreck your economy and screw up your elections. I think it's only about 99.99998% certain right now. But it is 100% certain that once it was out there, they deliberately spread it to this country. They banned internal air travel in China and they encouraged travel to the West. So we get hit with this disease, right? And this is election year for President Trump. And Fauci tells him, and the World Health Organization says, oh, by the way, they also did Black Lives Matter. That's a Chinese operation, 100%, run out of the Chinese consulate in San Francisco. So they did the COVID and Black Lives Matter. Then they did the elections. But anyway, so the COVID, I just lost my train of thought. Sorry, I don't often do that. So he was told by Fauci and the World Health Organization if he didn't shut down the economy, there's going to be 2 million dead before Christmas. An election year. So does this any patriotic president want 2 million Americans to die? And you imagine, had he not done it, imagine the media would have crucified him over every person who died. He was put over a barrel, so he shut down the economy. You know, 2 weeks flat in the curve, right? Yeah. Well, it went on and on and on. Now, got to understand, the Chinese gave us the COVID, but they also managed the response. All of the states with the harshest lockdowns and all the areas with the harshest lockdowns were the runs with the most Chinese influence. California, Washington, Hawaii, New York, Illinois, Massachusetts, where the Chinese communists had the biggest footholds and the most politicians on the payroll is where the lockdowns were the harshest. And that's all over the world, that same pattern holds. And they used their unions, which they control, to enforce the school closures to the teachers' unions and the Teamsters and other unions to picket shops and refuse to supply shops that tried to keep open through the pandemic. So they gave us a disease and they managed a response. See, this is, the Chinese have something they call the mass line. This comes from Mao Zedong. You know, it is a dictate comes from the Communist Party. And everybody must follow the mass line. In the Cultural Revolution, they had a mass line at one time. Everybody had to kill 10 flies every day. In the whole country, everybody had to kill 10 flies because there's too many flies. So that was what you did, 10 flies every day. If you didn't, you were in trouble. They also had at one point you had to go out and kill sparrows. And they killed all the sparrows who were eating the insects because the sparrows were eating the grain. So they killed the sparrows and the insects exploded and ate far more grain and caused the famine. But the point is mass line. Now, did you see mass lying over COVID? There was only one way. It was going to be lockdowns and quarantines and vaccines. It was never going to be hydroxychloroquine. It was never going to be vitamin D. It was never going to be herd immunity. It was never going to be anything but the Chinese model. Harsh lockdowns, masks, vaccines, that was the only way out of this. And in China, if you disobeyed the mass line, you were jailed or executed or thrown out of your job. What happened in America if you bucked the mass line? You're cancelled, right? What if you're a medical doctor who is prescribing hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin? What happened to your license? What happened if you tried to put out a paper there saying, no, there's a better way to handle this? You're cancelled. This is mass line Chinese politics, enforced the most rigorously in Chinese-controlled states like California and Massachusetts. The freer states like Florida said, to heck with it, we'll do our own thing, and it turned out much better. But it's mass line. What happens if you say on a Facebook post, I really think Black Lives Matter are a horrible Marxist organization? Would you dare to do that if you worked in a big corporation? Would you dare to challenge the orthodoxy that Black Lives Matter is all about anti-racism and that America is hopelessly racist? Would you dare to do that in some woke corporation? And what about if you say, I really don't think that cutting breast tissue off healthy 17-year-old girls is a good thing to do? I really don't think we should be encouraging young boys and girls to change their gender. What happens if you do that, folks? Do you get a little bit of flack for it? Certain states you wouldn't even dare to do it. In Michigan, if you tell your kids that, they'll take your kids away from you now. This is mass line politics. There is only one way. There's only one possible way we're going to deal with this problem. And if you, well, climate change is the same. You know, you're a scientist and you say, I don't think climate change is real, man-made climate change. I think the only climate change is fall, summer, winter, spring. You know, you're going to lose your grants, are you not? Because we all know that 95% of scientists agree with whoever's funding them. But that's the mass. We've got to understand, we have mass line Maoist culture in our society now. And that's what the woke church is. This is Maoist mass line politics. All these pastors repenting of their white privilege and, you know, debasing themselves in front of their things, worshipping Black Lives Matter, all this kind of, this is the same as they did in the Cultural Revolution, where they got people up in front of crowds to apologize for owning two pigs when everybody else only had one. Now you got to apologize for your white privilege. You got to apologize for your homophobia. You got to apologize for your lack of social justice and environmental awareness. This is Maoist politics in America. Does this sound a little over the top, folks? A little hyperbolic? This is exactly what it is. So we get hit with that. Now here's the kicker. Does anybody believe there may be another pandemic in the future? Okay. Or a health emergency of some kind. See, this is the thing. You've heard that all around the world now, the World Health Organization signed up virtually every country, and they're still trying to do it with Biden, that in a future health emergency or pandemic, the World Health Organization will completely control our response. All over the world. Biden's trying to do this now. So it's a new pandemic. You don't get to decide in Oklahoma what the treatment is. The World Health Organization decides. Okay? Now, the head of the World Health Organization, Mr. Tedros, the man who told Trump to shut it all down, is a former leader. He's not even a medical doctor. He's a former leader of Ethiopia's pro-Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese put him in that position. That's what he is. He's a communist functionary. Now, the World Health Organization has another as a subgroup, it's called the Behavioral Modification Unit. So that's a unit staffed by social psychologists who will manage your response to the next health emergency. They will message things so you adopt the vaccines they require, or the lockdowns, or the quarantines. They will be guiding your thoughts, and they will use fear and intimidation and propaganda to make sure you comply. Well, that unit is headed by Susan Mickey of the United Kingdom. She's a Brit. Now, Susan Mickey advised Boris Johnson on his lockdowns, and she was the one who said we might have to wear masks for the rest of our lives. She was known as the mask Nazi, a total fanatic. But guess what? In her 60 years in the British Communist Party, which she's still a member of, she was known as Stalin's nanny because she was so extreme, even by communist standards. She has worked for the Chinese government. She has praised the Chinese government. And she is in charge of the unit which will tell you what to do in the next health emergency. This is the greatest potential grab of sovereignty we've seen in world history, folks. The whole world could be controlled by Tedros, by Susan Mickey and Xi Jinping. And a health emergency doesn't necessarily mean a pandemic. Guns are a health emergency. Anti-trans can be a health emergency. You know, fundamental Christianity could even be a health emergency for the mental health of all these young children who are indoctrinated by these horrible people. Do you see where this could go, folks? So we are living in revolutionary times on the international front and in America. And in Oklahoma, you are more insulated than most. But anybody who goes to college here now knows, anybody who's got kids in college here now knows, the indoctrination in the colleges is as bad here as anywhere else. And they're getting hold of your kids. You're going to send your young Christian son or daughter to college. And in 3 years, they're going to come back and tell you how racist you are and how much they hate America. And they're not going to church anymore. Thanks very much. Does anybody know anybody that's happened to? So that's where we are, folks. So what do we do about this? Look, people always say to me, Loudon, give us some hope. Give us some hope, Loudon, you know. And I say, yeah, we all like hope. But Dennis Prager said something really, really powerful at a meeting in Florida I went to about a year ago. He said, look, I say all these bleak things and horrible things that are happening, and everybody asks me for hope. And he says this, he said, it is not hope, as adults, it is not hope we should be asking ourselves for. The question we should ask ourselves every day is, are we doing God's will or are we not? That is the first question. Because if you're doing God's will every day, you have hope eternal. You've always got hope in your heart. If you're looking for hope outside yourself, it's because you don't have it within you. Because you're not confident enough, you don't believe enough, you don't have enough faith to sustain you. And he says, so that is the question. If we're doing God's will, what do you fear? Doesn't matter how bad things get, you're still going to be okay, right? Your family's still going to be okay. We've got a fighting chance. Things are going to be the best they can be. Somebody's not going to come and save us. President Trump's not going to save us. The governor's not going to save us. What is going to save this country are the grassroots Christians and the grassroots patriots, returning to the truths that we were brought up with. That's what's going to save this country. And that's down to all of us. You know, we are in the trouble we are because our leaders politically and in the churches have let us down. But we let that happen, folks. You know, when you employ somebody and he rips you or your company off, whose fault is it? Him? And you didn't check him out properly and you don't watch him. Whose fault is it you get ripped off? Is it his or is it yours? Exactly. The buck stops with the boss. And in the American system, the boss is the individual citizen. We are the bosses of America. We delegate that authority out, then we don't pay any attention to what they do, and then we blame them for when things go wrong. So, this is where we are, folks. We're in one of those times that's very critical. We've been here before, but perhaps worse this time than any other, because in the last 150 years, faith has taken a battering. The age of science, the age of evolution has really hurt faith. You know, faith is dwindling. You know, not in individuals necessarily, but the number of people who are interested in these questions are dwindling. And society is suffering in the process. Now, so we have a lot of arguments in the churches, for instance, about a lot of pastors will say to you, well, look, I know the country's falling apart. Yeah, I know that. But I don't really want to do anything about that because if I do, I'm countering God. Because the worse things get, that means Jesus is coming quicker. Okay? And I say to people like that, I say, oh, okay. So your 2-year-old daughter falls in the swimming pool right there and she is drowning. Let's let her drown because that's going to create more misery and that's going to bring Jesus back quicker. You okay with that? People, we are given brains, we're given hands, we're given voices, we're given hearts. We're supposed to proclaim truth. You know, Book of Genesis tells us we're supposed to have dominion over the world. We are supposed to subdue the world. That's in there. Subdue. We're meant to have mastery. We're meant to use our talents to make the world a better place, to make it freer and more prosperous, so the gospel has more opportunity to spread, so more people live better lives. Is that not what the message of Christianity was for nearly 2,000 years? Christianity is an optimistic religion. Christianity civilized the savages, brought prosperity to God-forsaken countries. Christianity sent missionaries all over the world to teach people to read and write so they could read the Bible and make their lives better and build economies and make wells so they could have fresh water and have hospitals so their kids wouldn't die of stupid diseases. Was that not how Christianity worked for 2,000 years? So where does it say that the worse things get, the happier we should be? Jesus didn't know when he was going to return. So why do we? But don't worry, we'll all get raptured next Tuesday, people will say. Well, yes, someday the world's going to end. Exactly. But I just saw Christianity obliterated in northern Iraq by ISIS. And I see Christianity being obliterated in Nigeria today by Muslims coming down from the north and slaughtering thousands of people. Horrible, horrible tortures, church burnings, disgusting atrocities. I didn't see any of those Iraqi or Nigerian Christians get raptured. But American Christians are all going to get taken away before things get bad, right? Because clearly God loves American Christians more than he loves Iraqi Christians or Nigerian Christians. Is that the argument? People, we are told to occupy till he comes, to the very last second. People, do Christians have a responsibility to their families? Absolutely, right? Do Christians have a responsibility to their church? Okay. Do Christians have a responsibility to their community? Their community around them. Christian or non-Christian, right? You have a responsibility. So how come millions of Christians feel they have no responsibility for their country? They have no responsibility for making this country better or saving it. None whatsoever. They live in the world's richest country, the world's freest country, the most prosperity anybody's got, but they have zero responsibility, zero civic responsibility at all. None. If you read the Old Testament and you look at all the stuff about governments and borders and building walls around your city and wise kings and wise rulers, can you tell me that civil government is not a godly institution? The church is a godly institution, right? The family is a godly institution, correct? So you're telling me that civil government, the governance of our communities and our country, is not a godly institution? Doesn't mean there's not ungodly people in it, but it's a godly institution. The Old Testament is a national security blueprint. It's civics lesson after civics lesson. What happened to the Israelites when they didn't bother to put a wall around their city? What happens when they, you know, when they had bad kings? What happened to them? It was all about protecting communities, government. It was all about setting the stage for the time when Jesus would come to earth. So he had something to come into. He didn't come to abolish the laws of the Old Testament. He came to fortify them and build on them. There's a reason the Old Testament comes before the New Testament, people. There was a foundation being laid. And our constitution is based on those foundations. We are the first country in the world that said our government comes from God, not from government. Our rights come from God, not from government. That concept gave people the freedom to build the greatest nation the world has ever known, to build great churches and great universities and great hospitals and great businesses, to tame the frontier, to save the world from tyranny in World War II, to stop communism, you know, under Reagan. It did all of those great things for the world, built on that great foundation. Any Christian who tells you we have no responsibility for maintaining that, here's the argument. If your next-door neighbor is starving and you're a very righteous pastor and you refuse to help your next-door neighbor with some food, are you really a good Christian? So if your town has been threatened by a fire, the fire's raging through the grasslands coming at you, and everybody's out there with monsoon buckets and putting up, you know, barriers and evacuating people, but you sit at home and pray all day, are you a really good Christian? So when your country, with a constitution directly inspired by the Bible, which has done more good in the world than any other, is threatened with destruction, and you believe you have zero responsibility for doing anything about that, are you really a good Christian? Really? Am I being too harsh? Here's a little, we'll go back. Go back to World War II. Which force, there was one force in Germany in the 1930s, that had the numbers and the moral authority to stop Hitler. And that was the German church. And did they? They put swastikas in their churches. They became good Nazi Christians. Like we're doing today with the rainbow flags, etc. They accepted Hitler. Hitler said, "You look after the souls of men, I'll look after Germany." And the German churches said, right on, with a very few noble exceptions who often suffered greatly for standing up. The Bonhoeffers of the world and others. Okay, so Hitler came to power, started a major war which killed 80 million people. And who had to sort it out? Who had to clean up the mess? It was hundreds of thousands of young American Christian boys and Aussie boys and New Zealanders and Canadians and French kids who left their farms and their factories, and they put on uniforms and they picked up guns and they charged German machine guns on the beaches of Normandy. That's who fixed the mess, people. We've heard the famous story, and I don't even know if it's true, but it illustrates the point about the little church in Germany during World War II. And they're on a railway siding, and trains would come up right next to the church, and they're all singing one Sunday morning, just singing away. And a train pulls up outside, and there's boxcars, and they hear banging from the boxcars. Help us, we are thirsty. Water, water, help us, help us, help us. This is Jews or gypsies going to the camps. And what did those German Christians do? They sang louder. So you tell me this, people. On the day of judgment, who would you rather be? Would you rather be a German Christian who was good to his neighbors, who was honest in business, faithful to his wife, raised a great family, went to church every Sunday and prayed every single day, but when called upon to save his brother, failed? Or would you rather be a 19-year-old boy from Oklahoma who died face down in a pool of blood on Normandy Beach? Who would you rather be on Judgment Day, folks? Who do you think honored God more? Who was the coward and who was not? So this is where we are, folks. We're in such a time that we have to choose. Because evil is stalking the land. We're seeing it all around us. But we are still the majority. You know, after 5 years of, I won't get into it. Look, we are still the majority. Most people are still decent people in this country. And whether they go to church or not, they still have some degree of Christian values and some degree of respect. There's still that massive reservoir in this country. And everywhere I go, all around the country, I see new church groups springing up, new political groups, new grassroots groups, Moms for Liberty, people just standing up and defending their kids and trying to take this country back everywhere I go. And I tour all over this country. It's happening, it's rising, folks. But the left are enemy, are the minority, and they're trying to intimidate us to give up, to be cowards, to say, no, it's too hard, I'll just wait it out and just try and be a good Christian and just let it all, hope it'll go away or whatever. They're trying to intimidate us. This is the time we're going to be saved with the help of divine providence. I don't see any way out of this other than some divine help. But where does divine providence come in? You know, was there some divine providence when David picked up his little rock and his bit of string and took down Goliath? You think God helped guide that rock? But how much courage and how much faith did David have to show before God would help him out? When Gideon's 300 faced the horde, Gideon kept knocking down the number. No, you don't need 5,000. No. How much courage do you think those 300 have to face that horde? How much faith was behind that? God was sending a message. We don't need everybody. We need people of courage and faith. And I will help. When your boys fought the Germans or the Japanese, you imagine being on a landing barge. I remember hearing a story the other day, a sergeant on a landing barge and all these terrified 19-year-old kids about to pile out onto the beach. He said, boys, there's two kinds of people on this beach. There's the dead and those about to die. Let's go. Can you imagine the praying that would have been going on? Can you imagine the soul searching that would have been going on to do that? The sacrifice that went into that. And not all of them survived, but enough survived to carry the day. Your founding fathers, a bunch of shopkeepers and fishermen and farmers and blacksmiths with squirrel rifles, BB guns effectively, who went up against the world's greatest military empire. You know, how crazy were they? And all I had was this wacky idea that had never been tried, that man's rights come from God, not from government. And they were beaten in almost every battle. They were chased across every state. They were in Morristown, New Jersey, through the winter of 1780, on the verge of destruction. And George Washington went down to Valley Forge, and he got down on his knees, and he prayed, and he got up, and he led those starving troops down to Yorktown and took out the British in a surprise attack and turned the course of the war. People, we don't need everybody, but the people we have must be real. They must believe, they must be confident in their belief, they must have depth, and they must have courage, and they must be loud. Because when God looks at people like that, who are standing up courageously and telling the truth, He knows they believe. He knows beyond doubt. Anybody can say, I believe, it's when you have to put something on the line to prove it. That's when the miracles happen, people. You know, your revolutionary troops, the famous fog that came down on New York Harbor just at the right time to save George Washington's troops. The bullets that went through his helmet, but never through him. You know, many miracles happened in World War II. Many miracles have happened to this country, because I do not think God wants this country lost, folks. Why would He give us the Bible, and why would He give us a constitution if He wanted us to fritter it away? He wants us, we are stewards of a great country. You show me in the Bible where God favored the lazy and the cowardly over the brave and the kindly. You know, the boys tending a farm, one's a wastrel, one's not. Who did God favor more? No, the message is very, very clear. We're supposed to be brave, we're supposed to be courageous, we're supposed to be diligent, we're supposed to be honest, we're supposed to be hardworking. And if we follow that, those principles, we prosper and our children live free. It's how it's worked for a long time, hasn't it? So why would we think it's somehow a good idea to let it all slip away? How do we even think we have the right to do that? We are free, I'm fired up tonight, people. We are free because your uncles and grandfathers and great-grandfathers and the women who supported them, who kept the farms going and raised the kids and sent stuff overseas and wrote letters and defended their own properties, all of your ancestors risked their lives and laid it all on the line to give us this amazing freedom and prosperity we enjoy. Do we owe it to them to preserve what they handed down to us? They sacrificed to do it, give it to us. Why do we get a pass? Why do we never have to sacrifice? Why do they have to sacrifice and not us? Because if we don't, our kids will. Do we not owe it to our children and our grandchildren to hand on, to do whatever is necessary, to make whatever sacrifices it takes to make sure they get handed on a country at least as good as we found it? Is that our obligation or is it not? So I don't know how it's going to turn out, folks, but I do know this. If we do nothing with this great country and the opportunities we have been given, our children will live in slavery and they will not thank us for it, nor should they. But if we give it everything that is within us, everything that we believe, and we sweat blood and take risks for our beliefs and be courageous, two things may happen. One, we may give it everything we've got for our God, our country, and our kids, and maybe we fail. But all of us will at least earn the right to look our children in the eye and stand before our gods saying we are great, we are good and faithful servants. But if we win, and I believe we absolutely can win this, folks, we can set things up. We can start a liberty revolution which will not only take America by storm, but all around the world. We'll set the stage for a much needed spiritual revival. The byproduct will be much more economic prosperity. That's the byproduct. And all of us will earn the right to pass on to our children, not just the amazing country that many of you inherited and some of us came to, but one even greater, one that may lead the world for hundreds of years in the future in freedom and prosperity and spreading truth. It's just the chance of that worth some sacrifice, people. Just the chance of it. So I say to all of you, thank you so much for what you do for America, for my country, and for liberty. Thank you for supporting Pastor Blair. Thank you for supporting Dan Fisher and the great works that happen in this church. What happens here inspires people all over the country, folks. Never forget that. So God bless every single one of you. God bless this great state. And thank you so much for having me here tonight. Thank you.